right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole? This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. Now live, Tuesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. This is your host, Jason M. Caldwell, with my most awesome original co-host, Andrea Vitimus. How are you doing tonight, Andrea?
Hello. Busy as usual. You know how it is. You know how it rolls.
Yes, sir. Things are finally sort of getting ready to wrap up for you as far as your master's degree, I hope.
Last class.
So, as everyone is going to be aware from our previous episode, we are no longer with the Para-X Network, but we want to point out that we are very thankful for the time we spent there.
Yeah, we definitely are appreciative, and also, we have some of the hosts leaving our show as well. So, many, many changes. And like we said, we're going to keep doing the shows as we can. And we're very gracious and grateful to the previous, to Para-X Network. We just, like we said, couldn't keep up the weekly thing. But we also have some other news coming up. We're rolling into the next Do Magic Challenge. On August 1st.
August 1st is coming very quickly, Andrea. So what is the topic of this next Do Magic Challenge?
So this challenge will be on summoning spirits or evocation, where you can summon one or multiple spirits for a purpose every day for 30 days, or you can meditate on your experience and try to summon that, work up to one big summoning. It's completely up to you how you do it, but in some way it has to involve a working towards spiritual evocation versus invocation, and defined by evocation not necessarily as a binding or hostile, controlling, demanding, but you know, more like bringing forward towards you as opposed to in you, which would be more like strong possession work or strong mediumship. So
this is evocation, not invocation. People always get this confused.
Well, yeah. So basically, exactly. Evocation, it doesn't necessarily have to be like the chains and Galicia. It can be almost anything, but you're not really trying to pull the spirit inside your body. You're trying to have communications or make contact, or it's totally up to you how you do the logistics. As long as you journal every day for 30 days, actually sit down to do the work every day, and actually have at least one summoning that is, because some workings actually could take 29 days to get ready. And then there's one big ritual, which that happens sometimes.
Oh, if you're any kind of a grimoire purist, you could spend a lot of time just getting the stuff you need to prep.
Exactly. So it should be a good time. People have, I think the last challenge, people got real crazy. It got real crazy as far as personal results. Always when we do this magic for 30 days and these sprints and kind of the research and all of it, there's just huge life changes. It's just, it's phenomenal and humbling to see it each time.
You should also tell people, sir, what you got coming up Labor Day weekend, because that's coming faster than we think also.
Yeah, I'll be in Toronto for the first time in a couple of years teaching classes, shape-shifting classes, fire magic classes, and I'll have a pre-copy, hopefully, version of the fire magic book with specific rituals that I won't release in the public version.
Where is the easiest place for folks to get the info and sign up?
AndreaVenomous.com. Or you, if you're in Toronto, you can call the Wujizhen Wellness Center, which is where it's going to be at.
And that is Zachary Louis' shop.
Yep, that's his store.
Yeah, I don't know whether to call it a store or call it a clinic. It's more of a clinic, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it's more of a clinic. Yeah, it's not a store. I don't think he has many retail things in there.
But he is offering you some of the best in Toronto's Chinese medical services.
Yep, he's one of the best acupuncturists in Toronto. People, I have had his work. Jason's had his work. It's amazingly awesome acupuncture and just way better than most people when I get to acupuncture.
I'm going to say something a little personal. I'm going to tell you, Zach's like a younger brother to me, to the point that I would not let my actual blood younger brother poke me with needles. But I'll let Zach do it.
There you go. That doesn't get any better than that.
Oh, that's probably blasphemous to say, but you get the point.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I so do.
So, do you have any other announcements to add, sir, or should I let people know who our special guest is this week?
We should just jump right in, because we have a very, 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 very pleased to have our guest today. So, you know, because while we won't name the name yet, because I'm going to let you do it, because that's what we agreed. Like, this particular author has written at least 5 or 6 books that sit on my shelf right off the bat. So that tells you something right there.
Dr. Stephen E. Flowers, who received his doctorate in Germanic languages and medieval studies from the University of Texas at Austin and studied the history of occultism at the University of, and he can yell at me later if I get this wrong, Göttingen, Germany. The author of more than 24 books, including Lords of the Left-Hand Path and Original Magic, he lives near Smithsville, Texas, and you can check out his personal website at seekthemystery.com. How are you doing today, Dr. Flowers?
I'm doing very well, thank you. A little bit warm here, but that's Texas in the summer, so not to be unexpected.
Oh, yeah, it's been crazy hot here in Ohio also, sir. We get it.
We're prepared. We have air conditioning, and I've had it for a long time.
No worries. We've got ours running, too. So, Dr. Flowers, I want to get into, first off, I didn't know a whole lot about the Fraternitas Saturni until I was able to look at your book, and I've learned a lot. So, I wanted to know, how did you first hear about this order, and what made you interested?
Well, first I heard about it many years ago, back in the 70s. There was this sort of encyclopedia called Encyclopedia of the Unexplained. It was edited by Richard Cavendish, and anyway, it was just a series of sort of thing, books, you know, an encyclopedia, a lot of pictures and things, and it had a whole article in there about this order, and it just said that it was a very secret thing, but that certain documents had just recently been released, this great compendium of things, and but I searched for that, and that was really nowhere to be found. It turned out later that this was a very privately published thing that the author of the Richard Cavendish or whoever wrote the article had seen, but and probably couldn't read. But in any event, it was something that set me off looking for this thing. And then when I studied in Germany, in Göttingen, I studied occultism. Did a course there with a professor who taught that kind of thing. And he had these books, of course, so I was able to acquire them, or copies of them, and other materials that I spent that year just not really studying fraternity things, but rather just collecting the materials that I said, well, I'll collect them here, and then later on I will write a book about it. This was a completely scholarly adventure as far as that's concerned. But started in the early 70s, that by the early 80s I had acquired the materials, and by the very end of the 80s I wrote the books. It was a 20-year process of first becoming curious about it to finally actually completing something in relation to it.
So, this had remained a very secret order up until the 70s. How were you able to go, hey, I'm interested, and go find these materials and acquire them so quickly?
Well, because this the professor there named Adolf Hemberger just got these documents in the early 70s, ran them off, just like, Xeroxed them, and published them. And as a kind of a study in original documents of the secret order, so he kind of blew the lid off of the whole thing. And although you see that they're just Xeroxes of typescript pages from the private archives of the order, it wasn't really a book per se, it was bound pages.
Sure, and, so that, pretty much that, just their notes.
Went out there, but then the order said, okay, lid's been blown off our secret as far as our rituals and things like that are concerned, so we're going to reorganize now and then write new rituals and do some new things. And so that's why subsequently I've had the support of the order in writing these books.
Oh, wow.
For this book and its various editions, because I'm at pains to say I am not giving you the secrets of the Fraternitas Saturni as it exists now, but rather the way it existed up to 1971. So with that adjustment in my approach, they agreed that that's a fine thing. It was translated into German, original, the first edition was, and was greatly supported over there. And it's generally the introduction for Germans into the whole thing as well, as far as people who aren't in the order. Now, I don't think I go into this in the book because it's just not that relevant to my purpose there. But, for example, still to this day, if you one wished to become a member of the Fraternitas Saturni in Germany, they have an annual conference. One petitions, goes, presents themselves, presents their application and that sort of thing. It's taken. They say, thank you very much. Now you get on the train, go back home, and in a year you come back, or come to our conference next year, come to this chamber or one like it, and we will give you our answer as to whether you will be admitted or not.
Oh, wow.
So it's a pretty rigorous, certainly not a group that's trying to recruit people. It's not their interest to do so. And so that's the way it always was or has been for many years.
You know,
there is another order mentioned in the book that's called the Ordo Saturni, the Order of Saturn, and that has a orient or a group in Toronto. Are members in North America, but it's not of the Fraternitas Saturni itself, but of an offshoot group that also exists in Germany called the Ordo Saturni.
You know, I kind of like the idea of you have to show up in person twice before you even find out if you're going to get in. Mainly because, I mean, there's so many offshoot orders these days that will just take an online application. Well, it seems more authentic to me to actually have to show up in person twice.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, in a small country like Germany, where people, it's a train ride to wherever within the country, or Austria in Germany, it's not that hard to do. If it was a worldwide thing or something of that nature, it would be different. But since they, except for the materials I've produced and whatever is being done with this bunch in Toronto, all of the materials that's voluminous, filling many, many volumes of published work, is all, of course, in German. So if you don't speak German, then you can't be a part of it. So it's got that kind of a seal on it, as it were.
So I just find it interesting that this got leaked out, and they worked with you directly, and I'm sure it helped that you speak fluent German. So they weren't angry about this. Having to reorganize and having to
No, because I put the caveat or the thing on it saying, I am not, revealing your secrets. For example, orders get very upset about that approach, when, Francis King, was it, wrote that book. Now, that book on the secret rituals of the OTO. Remember that one that Weiser published back in the 70s? And the OTO sued Weiser, and it was actually removed, from the list and all of that sort of thing. And the thing that really angered them or made them upset was it said, here are the secret rituals of the OTO. This is like had that kind of approach that we are ripping the lid off and showing you what they don't want you to know, right? That kind of gets the group somewhat upset. And so that was why I was at pains to say, I'm not doing that here. This is something that's already been done, not by me, but someone else previously. And so I'm just doing this. And, of course, I tried to make it such that it was a honest, objective, but sympathetic and highly scholarly approach to it. You don't have to try to make it more sensational than it is. It already is sensational, so just tell what is it's about, and that will be quite sufficient as far as being interesting is concerned. So it was not something that I approached in the same way as some others might have. So it was appreciated. The foreword of the book, preface or something, is written by Frater U.D., who is a very high initiate in the Fraternitas Saturni now, and has been for many years.
Someone else who Andrea and I actually like quite a bit as far as his books are concerned. So, that being said, am I getting the history correct that this group predated the Golden Dawn?
No. Only in their own mythology, as it were. I mean, not the group as incorporated called Fraternitas Saturni. That just really goes back to the 1920s. So there were precursors to the group, the Panthosophical Lodge and other things in Germany. It's connected to the original, the sort of pre-Crowley OTO, of course, and their own mythology traces the lineage back supposedly to some Scandinavian order, Scandinavian and Polish group of Baltic states, but all of that's probably just like a lot of magical orders create all kinds of internal mythologies for various purposes, you know. But the Fraternitas Saturni is sort of a creature of Weimar Germany in all its you know, interests and ramifications.
So, how does this Brotherhood of Saturn relate to the work of Aleister Crowley?
Well, it just completely developed on its own. And then, because of the OTO connection, and when he became involved in that, and Crowley traveled around all over the place trying to get people to accept the law of Thelema and come under his umbrella, etc., there was this famous Vida conference in which Crowley attempted to bring these people into his orbit, and they did claim then at that point at this conference to accept the law of Thelema, but they did not accept the leadership of Aleister Crowley. So in the book, in my book on the subject, there are copies of letters that were sent back and forth between Gregor Gregorius and Aleister Crowley on this topic. And it was generally the idea that they just added Crowley to their eclectic mix, you see.
Hmm.
And he knew them, he was around there, and attended this conference, the book that Inner Traditions published some time ago, called The Beast in Berlin, kind of goes into some of that. And so, it would be a real stretch, you know, to call the Fraternitas Saturni a Thelemite group, in the sense that it's dominated or an overriding domination by that philosophy even, but it is a significant part of it. But they were, I suppose, wise enough not to get involved with Crowley personally and get involved in the drama. There's enough drama supplied by history to keep most people busy, or at least those people busy for without having to deal with his added disruption.
I was going to say, they're serious.
Yep.
Yeah, they seem to have enough drama of their own.
Yeah, having Rhea.
Or being misunderstood.
Yeah, well, that's the war and disruption and that's a pretty significant amount of drama there in most of those people's lives.
So, what makes the Brotherhood of Saturn unique among other magical orders of their time?
Well, one thing is the curriculum being very sort of objective, that there's a definite idea about what is to be done and when, the order, the degree system being really a curriculum of learning rather than just, okay, these symbols, like, it's based on the Masonic symbol system, but its content is really a sort of more like a school, like this degree means this thing, you should study that thing at that point and master that, or at least become familiar with it, and so forth. So it's more of a curriculum than where you might expect otherwise, a kind of training curriculum. So, and then you'll see that many of the people involved with, there's a kind of a German characteristic, Franz Baden the same way, Barton was sort of on the periphery of this group also. Everyone was kind of touched by it, but it's to say that it was somehow in control, I think, would be inaccurate. I think it was more of a zeitgeist, to use a German word, that was present there and then, and sort of put its stamp on everything that happened. So you see people who remember, such as Carl Spiesberger, almost nothing of his has been translated, but he has a curriculum of training that was based on the Fraternitas Saturni one, or he created much of the Fraternitas Saturni curriculum of magical training. Franz Barton and his initiation into hermetics and all of that was also part of it. In the book, I try to go and show some of the peripheral groups like Adonism and other things that were sort of in the sphere of influence of the Fraternitas Saturni, but not necessarily an orthodox part of it. Someone like the personality of Albin Grau, who was the guy behind the making of the film Nosferatu, he was never officially a member of the Fraternitas Saturni, but he designed a lot of their publications and did write for them and did things within and was a real architect of the group. And there's a publication actually by him, a magical work that he wrote that I've translated, and it's in an appendix in the Fraternitas Saturni book.
So you brought up Franz Barton and that he had somewhat of a connection to this group. Didn't Franz Barton villainize them to a degree in his work?
Well, he talked about there's a group that may or may not have actually existed called the Freemasonic Order of the Golden Centurion. It's one of the most storied, legendary sort of magical orders. And that's the group that he villainized in his book, Frabato, but that is largely can be said to be a mythological, autobiography in many regards. Right. After the Second World War, he is a Czech and living still in the Czech Republic, or in Czechoslovakia, was trying to distance himself from things that were associated with or anyone could associate with the Nazis. And so most of the stuff about him being persecuted by the Nazis and all that kind of stuff was just pure post facto mythologizing in order to divert any kind of attention from himself as having been involved himself in it. For example, he originally, in his original magical curriculum, which was written in Czech, and this came out, a person in the Czech Republic made it available to me and translated some of it. But anyway, he translated this Siegfried Adolf Kummer's book, Rune Magic, which I've also done from German, and it's available. But back in the 30s, this guy wrote this, and he made it a part of his original magical curriculum, the runes and that sort of thing. But then after the war, and that all being associated with Nazis somehow, that was removed, and he kind of rewrote his story to accord with being a more, a more innocent in the whole thing than he was, even though it's nothing more than an interest in that. It's not so much anyone was doing anything sinister or evil or in the sense of criminal or that sort of thing, but it just became that people who were interested in X, Y, or Z became a subject of suspicion immediately after the war. A book I of my next book with Inner Traditions is a new edition of my book Rune Might, which is about the runic magical tradition of early 20th century Germany, and that was published many years ago also, and also, but I've done an updated version and a lot of new history, just like in my, the Fraternitas Saturni book, a lot of new data about the personalities involved, and there I get into Barden a little more, and the story about these men who were oftentimes just rune occultists or whatever of the time, and they would, one individual, for example, Bernhard Friedrich Marby, he was a rune magician and that sort of thing, and he was then, the Nazis put him in, put him in a concentration camp, you know, and then he was in a concentration camp for 99 months, and so that was, and the war was over, and then he got out of the concentration camp, came home, and then he said to the Allies, where's my compensation for, you know, what the Nazis did to me and all that sort of thing? And they said, well, you are a person that we think is partially guilty of this sort of thing. You wrote about runes and things like that before.
Oh.
Or so we'll just, you know, no compensation for you. You're lives didn't help him, you know, that, so that's a typical kind of what happened to them at the, you know, that sort of circle drama. So, you know, that's what I meant by getting involved with Aleister Crowley. You probably don't need that kind of drama on top of
Dr. Flowers, I'm having a little bit of an issue with your cellular connection. You're breaking up on me a little bit. I don't know if there's anything you could do to...
Just a second.
Ah, the gods of technology not smiling upon us right now.
I had to leave the station a little bit.
So yeah, the mythicalization is interesting, but when you talk about in the book, the Fraternus, the Brotherhood of Saturn, actually had some interesting combinations of Gnostic thought, Luciferian principles, and kind of how they wove that into a kind of eclectic teaching school.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could talk about that a little bit, about what they actually believed.
One of the things that they had this interesting interpretation, and perhaps it was from their experiences, or their experiences leading to foresight into history. And when I wrote it, or summed it up and looked at it and said, well, look, this is something that's kind of interesting to say. I was writing it at the time just before the Soviet Union fell, and it was the late 80s, really, and the things, the Internet had not even come into vogue and that sort of thing, and their idea that there would be this age of Saturn, which would be characterized by what is occurring so rapidly in our globe, and that is a world in which power is increasingly funneled into fewer hands. It's a kind of an oligarchy and that sort of a thing, and so that there's this shift of power, money power, as well as other kinds of power, into few hands, and in this development of history in that direction, so that people were, and that was their view about what was going to happen. And this, of course, goes back in the early part of the century, their views, and my distillation of what they were talking about occurred in the late 80s, but I think, and so there weren't really that many signs of that sort of thing, in my mind anyway, at that point in time, but they, you know, it has since become more obvious that things like that are indeed what is going on. Now, as far as the Saturnian dimension of Gnosticism, they developed their interest is really in the area of not so much a lot of mainstream Gnosticism, I think, is what you might call it, but rather a kind of a left-hand path kind of Barbello Gnosticism, certainly Ophite Gnosticism, in which the serpent is seen as the good god, the Christos, and that Saturn is a kind of a initiatory master who is teaching his pupils, initiating them into the mysteries of the universe, and that's the way Saturn is seen, as a stern kind of schoolmaster or initiator of his students. But it being the light knowledge and the pure knowledge of the serpent being the object of the quest.
Now, interesting enough is because it presents a different take of Lucifer as kind of a boundary entry between the inner and outer worlds. They kind of talk about, and that Lucifer is in some ways portrayed as the, I might get this wrong, but the master of this Saturnal age of Aquarius, that is both the savior and kind of the taskmaster for the age. Like, if you can attune yourself to this, you can find a personal way through it, versus not. It's like it's the solution to the riddle of the age, in a way.
Right. But it's an individual quest. The individual, as Gregorius tried to teach, and thou art, as his poem says, thou art thine own god. So in that sense, he really defines and brings home the idea of the left-hand path being an individuation path.
Which is very interesting, because we're talking about an order from the Weimar Republic, and there wasn't a common place, it wasn't as common to talk about the left-hand path of becoming your own, you know, being, finding the godhood within, in public, in such a public sense as it is now. So this is kind of actually subversive for the time period that it's coming out in.
Right, but that's part of it, that it was a secret. They had some things they published where people who weren't members could read it, but those things are all, when you look at them, they are all they come across as just articles about occult topics like others, but they don't get into the philosophy. And that was something that was just preserved for the initiates themselves, so it was not anything public. If it were public, probably the average person on the street for most of Europe and America or wherever would be shocked, and if they just made explicit what is oftentimes by a lot of people, they just play games, saying, well, you know, it's this way, it's that way. They don't want to be pinned down to anything specific about what they're teaching, because they're afraid you know, if it caused a scandal or something like that. Well, the fraternity test fraternity being until 1971 a secret cult, and it was very much just used order names as kind of like in the Illuminati and things like that, so that people weren't even theoretically supposed to know what the person's civil name was. They just knew each other by their order names alone. And so they were even secret within their, it was completely alternative reality, as it were, within the lodge. So that helped keep secrets.
When we're actually talking about this, there's a lot of Masonic influence on the order, but like you kind of touched upon this, that unlike the Mason order, like these orders are actually more like a school. And maybe you can like talk about what you can as far as like what some of the grades would be and what you were expected actually to learn as you progress through the 33rd grades.
Yeah, well, most of it, as you see there, outline that in the book, you know, each grade as it is. And honestly, if you, that when you look into the sort of the economics of the thing, you see that Gregorius, what was he by trade? He was a book dealer, okay? And this is not uncommon in German occultism, or wasn't, you know, now, of course, it's probably not the case anymore. But these magical orders on one level could be seen as a way to create people to buy the guy's books, right? I mean, from his bookstore. So you need to learn about astrology. I happen to have a whole catalog full of astrological books, right? You now buy these and you'll learn about astrology. So that was kind of a dimension to it. I mean, I saw that with the Armanen Orden, this Armanic Guido von Liszt kind of group in Germany. The guy was the Grand Master of it as a bookseller also. Gregorius was that. I see that quite frequently in that. Well, before, you know, the advent of Amazon and that kind of thing. Each grade had a different occult skill or something of that nature to impart, but the whole grade system was one that was moving in a typical fashion, you know, through the planetary grades to the level of Saturn, you know.
Well, certainly this is not unlike all of our college professors. You know, here, buy my books.
Right, yeah. Well, they weren't necessarily his, you know, but they were. So I will say that about them, that they were pretty impressive that way, in the sense that it wasn't just, I want you to only read what I have written and what's been pre-digested for your, you know, consumption kind of an attitude, but rather... Here we need to read all of these things from all of these different people throughout history and time, and so it was really quite a well-rounded curriculum in, you know, occult studies, if you will.
So let's talk about some of their practical magics, because from what we were picking up in the text, this order, unlike, say, the Golden Dawn or the OTO, they had very little interest in Kabbalah and Tarot, and they had a much greater interest in pendulum, crystal, mirror magic, and demonic magics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they, you know, they'll have, yeah, it's just a matter of way. I think that the Fraternitas Saturni is extremely eclectic. I mean, I have their journal, the publication they put out from 1950 to 1964, and it fills like a whole book, you know, shelf full of things. It's like a, you know, thick volume for each year, and those articles will run the gamut from everything. There will be things in there about Kabbalah and Tarot, and here's some stuff on Aleister Crowley, and here's some things about secret cults and orders through history. It's just all kinds of material. So there's not a singular obsession, but there are those things that I think are more culturally specific, in the sense that if you go back in German occultism, things like mirrors and pendulum and hypnosis and things like that are just culturally more a part of their world than it was in England.
Well, having access to a lot of their eclectic practices, was there anything that you found as a magical practitioner that you really enjoyed, that you really wanted to look more into and add to your own practices?
Well, I didn't. I'm not an initiate of the order, and I just most of my things that are turned out to be Fraternitas Saturni based things were kind of filtered through some of the runic practices. That's where I started out. A man by the, I mentioned his name before, Carl Spiesberger, who was Frater Eratus in the Fraternitas Saturni. He was one of the most important teachers in the order, but he also wrote books on rune occultism and rune magic in the 1950s, and those are the rune magic books that I sort of started with in the 1970s. So in that sense, I learned Fraternitas Saturni style rune magic first. That was the first thing I was exposed to and that I actually worked with in the mid-1970s. So that would have to be the biggest single thing. And they had their own take on things. If you read Spiesberger's books, which none of which have been translated, but if you see, they're completely devoid of any of the racial doctrine and all that sort of thing that you would have seen in earlier versions of the same system in the pre-war period. It's just been taken into the direction of really looking at it more as patterns of energy and the flow of energy and things of that nature. And that's why that's all outlined quite a bit in my book, Rune Might. But that would be, one thing. And then also experimentation with the actual lodge ritual, to take the basic lodge ritual. Maybe make some changes in it as far as the symbols used, etc., to be in accordance with your particular tradition or the group you're working with at the moment, but using the basic formula as a way of working. I had a great success with that, not so much with myself, but having people participate in this and really having them have profound experiences that changed, or that's what they've said, had changed their lives in different ways. Put them onto a new path or made some, or opened their eyes to something they hadn't seen before, but in a profound, life-changing kind of way. So I think there is certainly power in these ritual formulas in my experience.
So interesting though, is because they're not just doing practical magic. They also have a set of sacraments and kind of religious things. One of the things that they're often notorious for, this order, but it's probably very misunderstood, is actually the sex magic that is part of that. But it's probably one of the things that most people, when they first ever look up the order, kind of that's the first thing that pops out at them, and it's often misunderstood. So maybe you could talk about how they actually did use the sex magic and how that fit in with the philosophies of the order.
Yeah, well, that's the idea, very fundamental to their philosophy, so much so that when the book was first published by Llewellyn, or the first version of it, first edition, Carl Weschke retitled the book Fire and Ice, because he was struck so much by the this sort of a fire and ice dualism. You know, not that one is good and the other evil necessarily in the way they're looking at it, but rather that there's these two centripetal and centrifugal forces in the universe, that these two contending poles of magnetic power, electromagnetic power, and that sort of an idea being very fundamental to their view of the whole universe. And then for them, then sexuality, masculine, feminine polarity, is a manifestation of that cosmological polarity. And so then, therefore, generating power through the use of these, the interplay between these polar opposite energies is a part of that cosmology. And they absorbed all kinds of tantric ideas about, you know, the rituals and the use of bodily fluids and that sort of thing to charge talismans and that kind of thing. It wasn't what was unique, or maybe you could say it was unique, or pronounced and emphasized by them, was the mirroring of the cosmos in this sexual polarity, that this cosmic polarity was mirrored in sexual polarity. And again, that is part of something that was very much a hot topic in there, with a time and place being Weimar, Berlin, 1920s in Berlin, birthplace of sexology and all of that sort of thing. If you ever see the book or know of the book called The Voluptuous Panic by Mel Gordon, that was published by Farrell House some years ago. It's a big kind of coffee table book, a bunch of great illustrations and material from the time period, but just as the erotic world of Weimar Berlin is called The Voluptuous Panic. And they're actually, in an appendix in that book, one of the Fraternitas Saturni rituals, you know which one, was reprinted in there, you know, with some Fraternitas Saturni imagery and that sort of thing. But so it was a part of that sort of zeitgeist again of the Weimar Berlin that was absorbed into the order.
So wasn't there sex magic pretty much male focused? It wasn't very friendly toward the women involved, was it?
Friendly? Well, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly magic in general. It seems to be a male-dominated thing historically. So, I mean, if you look at their rosters, which are things that appear in the publications, you see it's about 80 to 85% male, right?
Mm-hmm.
As far as who's even in it, who is involved. And one of the quote, it's very rare for the kind of, especially the kind of hardcore kind of magic and ideology they practice. Women are, usually not too interested in that sort of thing. And so much so, I point this out in the book, I think it's on page 72. Mozart wrote in The Magic Flute, that this a woman who is not afraid of night or death is worthy and will be initiated. But to find a woman who is not afraid of the night and death are generally rare. So that's, the you know, that's right. The greatest attorney there. You know, but these women, you know, who were they're going to be a minority in the order, but they will have positions of significant power or whatever. They could. Well, a woman became the grand mistress of the order at one point. So I mean, it was, it's just a sort of a sociological phenomenon of the time, but it's also a psychological thing. This kind of magic and this kind of curriculum is kind of this kind of hardness is something that's not very attractive to most women historically.
So this order is the earliest documentation I've personally seen of technological magic using machines of any kind in magic. Sure. You called it electrical magic in the book. The order even claimed to have a machine they could use to kill people at a distance. I kind of wanted to get into, like, what did you learn about their use of electrical magic and how it took part in their practices?
Well, it's a thing called a tepaphone, and it, from all the descriptions, I think what it was a kind of an arc, that electrical arc, and I think, you know, in all honesty, I think it's a. I'm a student of academic magic as well as esoteric magic, which I don't distinguish between myself. But you know, one of the things about magic that makes magic work, if you just to back up a step or two here, there's a famous article from long ago called "On the Reality of Voodoo Death," and it was written by a scientist who worked as a missionary or with missionaries in Africa, and knows that people would come and they would say to the infirmary and say, "I'm dying. I'm going to die. What's wrong with you?" He said, "Well, you know, shaman, whoever, you know, pointed this bone at me or said that I put this curse on me and I'm going to die." And they would say, "No, there's nothing wrong with you." They'd check him out. Nothing wrong. And then, but he said, "I'm going to die," and pretty soon he's getting sick, and then and he does die. And they do an autopsy, and so he died of just cellular shock. He just started to break down, you know, just his body. And this actually happens. Now, when we study how magic works in societies like that, it works on the basis of a frame of reference that when people believe strongly in this kind of a cosmology or this universe that in which such things are possible, and someone has the way to use the power within that frame of reference, they can cause things to happen that are extraordinary and what we would call magical, very profound, dramatic things. Now, in early 20th century Europe, America, European world, things like, "Oh, I got a dagger here, I'm going to stick it in this doll, or I'm going to do this," people go, "That's silly." You know, but you start breaking out some kind of machine that no one's seen before, like in the Frankenstein movies, even, you know, that kind of a thing, and you start blasting, say, this image or whatever, and you convince them that this is not magic so much, this is an unknown science, and we are pushing buttons, and we are doing things with this electrical power, which at the time was pretty new in people's minds. Most of them had been born in time, but before they even probably had electricity in their homes,
right?
And that kind of a thing. So this was like really high technology, and so the frame of reference of these symbols, things like Tesla coils and Van de Graaff generators and things of that nature, are invoke in people's minds a kind of a frame of reference which gives power over and above what the imagery from hundreds of years ago, which simply have lost a kind of a potency for that frame of reference key. And so I think the fraternity test attorney certainly took advantage of that kind of thing. And you see that, you know, you see a film like Metropolis, for example, which was made right at the time this was coming into being, and you see that kind of imagery. You have this Rotwang, this black magician with all these inverted pentagrams and things like that, but he's creating this robot, you know, this creature. He's like a half scientist, half medieval black magician kind of an entity, and that's the kind of symbolic world where the roots of the fraternity attorney are to be found. So, in a way, it just was not picked up much by others. People like Anton LaVey picked up on it, Temple of Set has picked up on it subsequently, but generally, you know, it's not something that has been carried into too many orders or magical curricula and that sort of thing. So that you say, well, if you're doing magic, you got to have a Tesla coil and a Van de Graaff generator and all of these kind of what we call mad lab things. But
I think nowadays you'd have to have probably a nuclear microscope or something like that to freak people out, like, you know.
I don't know how big a drama we've ever been in the presence of, when the hair stand, when that electrical charge goes up and the room is filled with this ionized it's like you're in the middle of a thunderstorm, you know, that kind of a thing. Like you've seen the pictures of Tesla, you know, in the middle of the storm of electricity and things like that's got to have an effect on you. You know, which it does, but and whether it has any magical effect, it does that thing. It taps into that frame of reference. It's I didn't believe in the voodoo doll, but well, you know, when that thing went off and these things started happening, you know, suddenly I became a believer, which is not to say that it's any. It's just where we live is taking, say, where are you now and what is going to push that button for a modern person to take this kind of what was then a modern kind of a thing. But it does have also the other dimension of it is that there are perhaps things about the way the atmosphere has changed, like I said, ionizing the atmosphere and charging it with the electricity and that sort of thing may have some effect on consciousness also.
So, we have been going for an hour, gentlemen, but we're going to start wrapping up, but Andrea, was there anything else that you wanted to bring up with the doctor while we have the opportunity?
No, just said I'm a fan. I've been a fan for a while, so I have lots of the Room books on my shelf. The old first editions and the stuff from the Room Guild. Which I never had time to actually get to, but I have it.
So, the Fraternita Saturni, Dr. Stephen E. Flowers, and you folks should go and check out, let me plug your website again while I have the opportunity, sir. His website is seekthemystery.com, so you can go there, check out his works, and support his work, because he's very studious, and you can learn a lot. We also want to thank him for giving us some physical copies of this book that Andrea and I are working out a little contest for the listeners to be able to get a free copy of the book.
That's right. That's right. And we're going to talk about that we're going to append that to the show, and we're going to put that, how you actually can win those books on the Facebook page. And so you can get a copy of this book, which has got It's got the actual, some of the rituals from 1970 in there that the Order used, as well as the history and how many different aspects this Order has kind of touched as far as the different occultists. So you can get all that, and it's actually really, really a really fantastic book. But we're going to tell you how to win that on our social media.
All right, so check out Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole on Facebook. And also, the page for this show on DDTRH.com. Well, Doctor, thank you for coming out and spending your afternoon with us recording this. We appreciate it.
Okay.
And I'm going to let the Illuminous... Oh, well, actually, let me give you the opportunity. Are there any public events you want to publicize that you're going to be doing soon?
Well, I'm sure I have a string of, works coming out with Inner Traditions. I have a new book to come out next week. Hope to take it to the printer. It's just a kind of a private thing, a book on a big book, sort of life work on the god Odin, on Wodanas, our ancestral sovereign god of wisdom. That's a big one. Inner Traditions coming out with a whole series, like I said, Rune Might next, and then a book on the Tarot, my Magian Tarok book, which is a Mithraic kind of a take on the Tarot, which was done by a Swedish scholar back in the 1920s. It was became very obscure. I'm sure you know Thomas Carlson, he's in Sweden, the Dragon Rouge guy. He's a big fan of this Sigurd Agril, and that's next. And then so those are books coming out with Inner Traditions, and then Wiser is coming out with a big book. It's kind of a compilation of my Rune books to put a lot of them together from the 80s. So there's a lot of things going on, but I have a lot of work to do here in the last few years of life. I'm over 65 now, so I'm just going to try to punch through the last, do the things I need to do, and then try to relax a little bit at the end here.
Right. Well, yeah. Thank you very much.
But, sure.
That's kind of awesome, actually, that you're coming out with that many books in that.
Yeah, if you look on my Wikipedia page, I didn't know how many I'd written. I looked on my some pretty solid fan of some kind of. I think there's more than one that does my Wikipedia page, and I've counted them. There's over 50 books, so. Or one length or another, but 50 major publications. So that's quite a bit, but more to do. Now a lot of people keep, like Inner Traditions or Wiser, keep coming. We want a new version of this or that. And it's like delays me, but it's worthwhile. These books are a whole lot better than the original ones. So I'm happy to see them.
I'm gonna have
okay,
to go.
Okay, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
I'm gonna have to go buy some of these new books as well. So
sure,
more books.
Pleasure, a pleasure speaking with you, sir. I'm going to let the Illuminous take us on out. Everybody, enjoy your week.